Welcome to S&C's podcast series, S&C's Critical Insights. My name is Jeff Scott, and I'm a partner in the litigation group. I'm here with my litigation partner, Julia Malkina. Today, we will discuss the priorities of the SEC's enforcement division and the enforcement trends as reflected by the types and volume of enforcement actions brought during the last 2 years. We will also offer some practice guidance concerning the handling of enforcement investigations in light of the SEC's priorities. Let's start with some numerical trends in SEC enforcement matters. In the wake of the last presidential election, there were many predicting a sharp decline in SEC enforcement activity, but the statistics regarding SEC enforcement matters show that these predictions were wildly off the mark. For example, the number of standalone enforcement actions have increased each fiscal year from 2017 to 2019, with 526 standalone matters having been brought in 2019 alone. This is one of the busiest enforcement years in the SEC's history. In 2019, the top five categories of standalone cases by primary classification were investment advisor and investment company cases at 36%, securities offering cases at 21%, issuer reporting and audit and accounting cases at 17%, followed by broker-dealer and market manipulation at a combined 13%. The SEC has also recently obtained a historic level of monetary remedies.
That's right, Jeff. In terms of monetary remedies, in 2019, the SEC obtained approximately $3.25 billion in disgorgement and $1.1 billion in penalties, for a total recovery of $4.35 billion. This is the highest total amount over the past 5 years. The median amount of money recovered by the SEC per case for 2019 was approximately $554,000, which is also the highest median amount by action over the past 5 years. As we will discuss later in the podcast, the Supreme Court's June 22nd decision in Lieu v. SEC upheld the SEC's power to seek disgorgement in federal court, subject to certain notable limitations. This is an important decision for the SEC, given how frequently the SEC uses disgorgement to recover ill-gotten gains. Let's shift now from numerical trends relating to enforcement activity to the SEC's identified areas of enforcement focus. In its 2019 enforcement update, the SEC highlighted a number of such areas. First, protecting Main Street investors. Both Chairman Clayton and the Enforcement Division have made clear that protecting retail investors is a core principle of the SEC. During the last 2 years, the SEC has brought hundreds of cases alleging misconduct directed at retail investors. In particular, the SEC has focused on its share class selection disclosure initiative, pursuant to which the SEC agreed to recommend standardized settlement terms against investment advisory firms that self-report their failures to disclose conflicts of interest associated with receipt of fees for placing clients in a 12b1 fee-paying share class when a lower-cost share class of the same mutual fund is available. To further its core objective of protecting retail investors, the SEC has brought cases focusing on affinity fraud, accounting fraud, Ponzi schemes, pump and dump schemes, and technology-driven securities fraud.
And consistent with its focus on protecting the retail investors, Julia, the SEC has brought a number of cases against public companies that allege fraud, deficient disclosure controls, misleading risk factor disclosures, and misleading presentation of non-GAAP metrics in contrast to GAAP metrics. The SEC has also brought a number of cases against accounting firms, including high-profile actions against two of the big four accounting firms. So what can we learn from the SEC's laser focus on protecting retail investors during the last 2 years? Well, as a result of this increased focus, the operations, activities, and disclosures of investment managers, investment advisors, broker-dealers, auditors, issuers, and other public companies continue to remain under close scrutiny by the SEC. Companies should therefore evaluate prophylactic measures they can adopt to reduce the risk of exposure. These measures can include, among other things, ensuring adequate compliance and legal staffing, periodic review and revisions to policies, practices, and procedures to ensure that the company has best practices, implementing effective employee training about compliance and regulatory obligations, adoption of an effective whistleblower program, and careful review of public disclosures by experienced professionals.
As you know, Jeff, the SEC also continues to stress the importance of holding individuals accountable, and the SEC has continued to pursue individuals as part of its investigation. For example, in 2019, 69% of the SEC's standalone actions, excluding those brought as part of the share class initiative, involved charges against at least one individual. In a recent speech regarding FCPA enforcement, the co-director of the Enforcement Division, Steve Peakin, echoed a point made by Chairman Clayton at his confirmation hearing, emphasizing that individual accountability drives behavior more than corporate accountability, a point which is supported by logic and experience. Moving to a practice pointer, given the SEC's focus on individual accountability, companies and their counsel should carefully consider representation issues throughout the life of an SEC investigation. Joint representation by a lawyer of a company and current or former employees when there is no conflict of interest can offer important advantages, including avoiding unnecessary legal expenses and providing counsel with a thorough understanding of the issues. In some instances, however, it may be advisable for current or former employees to retain separate counsel. In these situations, companies should carefully consider indemnification obligations and joint defense common interest agreements, pursuant to which relevant information may be shared.
Julia, as a result of profound technology changes affecting the markets, the Enforcement Division has dedicated significant resources to preventing cyber-related misconduct. In fact, the SEC 2 years ago established the cyber unit, and it has brought many actions centered on digital assets and initial coin offerings, or ICOs. The SEC has not only charged entities for fraud in connection with these ICO offerings, but it has charged companies and individuals with registration violations, unregistered broker-dealer activity, touting violations of the digital assets, and the unlawful operation of a national securities exchange through a digital asset trading platform. We expect that this area will continue to be very busy in the short and intermediate term, as the SEC has announced it has hundreds of cyber-related investigations pending. Now, beyond focusing on particular types of cases, the SEC is attempting to advance its priorities by employing specific enforcement strategies. For example, the SEC has emphasized the importance of coordinating with law enforcement. Noting that civil sanctions alone can be inadequate, the SEC has emphasized that it often refers matters to and investigates in parallel with criminal authorities. The SEC has noted that in 2019 alone, other regulators and law enforcement authorities requested access to its files in more than 400 of its investigations. As a result, counsel representing companies and individuals before the SEC should always be alert to the possibility that the SEC is coordinating its investigation with other regulators and law enforcement and thus proceed accordingly.
In addition to this coordination activity, Jeff, the SEC also has stressed that it will accelerate the pace of investigation, particularly for financial fraud and issuer disclosure cases. In 2019, the SEC averaged approximately 24 months between case opening and the filing of an enforcement action. The SEC noted that it hopes to lower this metric in 2020, especially in financial fraud and issuer disclosure cases, which took approximately 36 months on average between case opening and the filing of an enforcement action in 2019. This is because of the greater complexity of such cases.
Now, because meaningful cooperation in part can substantially accelerate the time frame for bringing a case, I believe that the SEC has stated that is looking to find additional ways, in their words, to message what companies and individuals have done to merit the cooperation credit they received. In some instances, of course, the SEC has included detailed information in public orders concerning the cooperation efforts of settling parties, and it anticipates that it will do that in the future too. Cooperation can, of course, take many forms. Some examples are developing search terms and methods to identify relevant documents, helping the SEC procure testimony of former and current employees, making presentations to the SEC about relevant investigation topics, and voluntarily providing factual information relevant to the investigation, among other ways of cooperating. Now, by offering such cooperation, a company may be able to avoid or reduce potential charges and penalties in connection with an SEC investigation. Now, with respect to a practice pointer, the SEC's stated focus on accelerating the pace of investigation creates opportunities for companies to cooperate with the SEC in an investigation. By engaging early with the SEC, companies can provide context for the conduct at issue and give the SEC a better understanding of the facts. This information sharing may narrow the SEC's focus or, in certain cases, even eliminate the need for an investigation. Companies also can offer the SEC ways to reduce the burdens associated with document requests and anticipated testimony. For example, companies can provide the SEC with a limited set of documents to establish certain facts that are at issue rather than engage in a large-scale document production. You also can allow the SEC to meet with relevant employees after appropriate preparation and provide letters to the SEC conveying substantive information instead of producing thousands of documents that both the company and the SEC staff will need to review. Now, counsel should be aware of the risks associated with an accelerated investigation, including less time for factual development and review of particular documents and the opportunity to speak to relevant individuals. And counsel should be sure to provide the SEC with accurate information during this accelerated investigation and always provide appropriate caveats about the work that has been completed before providing the information to the SEC staff.
Finally, rounding out the SEC's list of continued areas of focus is working to streamline and accelerate the evaluation of claims brought to the Office Whistleblower. The SEC noted that its Office of the Whistleblower, which was established in 2011, received a record number of tips in 2019. Whistleblower tips have resulted in over $2 billion in financial remedies since the inception of the office. In recognition of these tips, the SEC has awarded 83 whistleblowers over $500 million. The largest individual award came just this month on June 4th. That award was $50 million. The continued growth of the SEC's whistleblower program has important practical ramifications for companies. Companies should be alert to the possibility that a whistleblower has provided information to the SEC. Companies should take steps to make sure they understand all the relevant facts in an investigation so that they can place in proper context any information provided to the SEC by a whistleblower. Companies should also adopt and implement a whistleblower program that effectively responds to internal tips and complaints to protect itself from criticism regarding its handling of such tips and complaints.
Julia, let's turn to a developing area. It appears that the COVID-19 pandemic is having a significant impact on the SEC's enforcement priorities and likely will continue to have such an impact, at least in the short term. Now, in a May 12th speech, co-director Pekin stated that the SEC had formed a coronavirus steering committee comprising leaders across the enforcement division, as well as other divisions within the SEC. Now, among other things, this committee's mandate is to identify and monitor areas of potential misconduct.
And Jeff, the enforcement division has been quite active in addressing issues related to COVID-19 misconduct. For example, the SEC has issued more than 30 trading suspensions because of concerns about the adequacy and the accuracy of coronavirus information. The SEC also has pursued enforcement actions against certain companies for misstating their COVID-related abilities. It is notable that these actions were brought by the SEC within a matter of weeks of the SEC becoming aware of the alleged misconduct.
Also on March 25th of this year, the Division of Corporation Finance also issued guidance providing its views on disclosures for companies to consider in the context of COVID-19. The guidance noted that the division is monitoring how companies are reporting the effects and risks of COVID-19 on their businesses and it outlined a series of questions for the companies to consider in connection with their disclosure obligations, which focus on the impact of COVID-19 on a company's financial condition, resources, operations, balance sheet, and similar matters.
On April 8th, Chairman Clayton and the Director of Corporation Finance at the SEC issued a public statement about the importance of disclosures. The statement urges public companies to, quote, provide as much information as is practicable regarding their current financial and operating status, as well as their future operational and financial planning. The statement also, quote, encourages companies that respond to our call for forward-looking disclosures to avail themselves of the safe harbors for such statements.
Although the April 8th guidance states that the SEC would not expect to second-guess good faith attempts to provide investors and other market participants appropriately framed forward-looking information, it is safe to assume the SEC will closely monitor companies' COVID-19-related disclosures and bring enforcement actions if it deems those disclosures misleading or otherwise inadequate.
Jeff, switching gears from COVID-related developments to a hot-off-the-press Supreme Court development. Earlier this week, on June 22nd, the Supreme Court issued its much-awaited decision in Lieu v. SEC, a case challenging the SEC's disgorgement authority in federal court. The Supreme Court held 8-1 that disgorgement is a type of equitable relief that the SEC may obtain in federal court, subject to certain traditional equitable limitations that will be the subject of litigation for years to come. For clarity's sake, this decision does not directly affect the SEC's ability to seek broad disgorgement in administrative proceedings. In addition, a bill has passed the House of Representatives and is currently in committee in the Senate that would provide the SEC with broad disgorgement authority in federal court. But at least for now, the Lieu decision provides important limitations on the scope of disgorgement that the SEC may seek in federal courts.
Now, Julia, the court has set out, I think, three important limitations to be fleshed out by the lower courts. First, the court determined that the SEC is generally required to return a defendant's gains to wronged investors for the benefit. The court left open, however, whether and when the SEC's practice of depositing disgorgement funds with the Treasury may be justified if it is infeasible to distribute the collected funds to investors. The SEC has historically not returned all disgorged funds to investors. For example, in 2019 alone, the SEC returned approximately $1.2 billion of $3.25 billion of such funds to investors. We are thus likely to see the SEC test the scope of this limitation in the years to come.
In addition, the court concluded that disgorgement should be limited to net profits from unlawful activity. The court thus explained that lower courts must deduct legitimate expenses before ordering disgorgement. The Supreme Court left open, however, what counts as a legitimate expense. The scope of a legitimate expense also will likely be the subject of much case-by-case litigation in the lower courts. Finally, the court explained that collective liability, such as a joint and several disgorgement award, is off limits if it violates the common law rule requiring individual liability for wrongful profits. But the court noted that certain types of collective liability, such as that for partners engaged in collective wrongdoing, may be permissible. Here too, lower courts will need to look to equitable principles to determine whether collective liability is permissible in a given case.
Now, in light of the Supreme Court's decision in Lieu, we expect that the SEC will continue to consider and pursue non-monetary relief as well. Even before the Lieu decision, the SEC had sought in particular cases certain non-monetary relief, such as undertakings and an independent consultant to review the company's compliance with those undertakings and also the company's policies and procedures. The Enforcement Division has in fact recently stated that it will look to impose such non-monetary relief where the circumstances warrant. Companies should therefore carefully evaluate whether to agree to such non-monetary relief. While agreeing to non-monetary relief may reduce or eliminate penalties, companies should bear in mind that such relief, including recommendations by an independent consultant that are required to be adopted by the company, may be terribly expensive to implement and could involve years of work. One way to potentially avoid the imposition of undertakings and an independent consultant is to remediate any identified issues during the pendency of the SEC investigation such that there's nothing left to be done at the conclusion of the SEC investigation.
That's all we have for today. Thank you for listening to S&C Critical Insight. For more information about our practice, please visit us on the web at www.solcrom.com. Please also join Jeff and me for our S&C Critical Insights on recent developments in private securities litigation, a recap on important trends that we are seeing in securities cases filed by private plaintiffs in federal and state courts.